supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Some people say public discourse is in the gutter. The ACLU wants it to sink even deeper into the subway. The Civil Liberties Group is suing SEPTA over its advertising policy, saying a ban on political ads violates the First Amendment. WHYY's Jim Saska reports.
If you ride SEPTA, you've seen a few ads. A bus wrapped in a Pat's advertisement is like a billboard on wheels for a greasy 3 a.m. cheesesteak glory. Posters on the subway promote personal injury lawyers. SEPTA gets $16 million a year in marketing revenues. But there are also ads that you don't see, the ads SEPTA prohibits under a policy the ACLU calls unconstitutional. You see, SEPTA is a government entity, and ads are a form of speech. So when SEPTA bans certain ads, it's censoring speech, which the First Amendment usually doesn't allow.
Anytime that the government has vague standards that they use to censor speech, there's a real risk that the government will manipulate those standards to shut down controversial or unpopular speech.
That's Molly Tack Hooper, a lawyer with the Pennsylvania ACLU, who is suing SEPTA on behalf of the Center for Investigative Reporting. That group wanted to run a series of ads highlighting a story on racial disparities in mortgage lending. SEPTA rejected the ad, saying it was political.
SEPTA's whole purpose here seems to be to cut off anything that might be controversial.
That's precisely SEPTA's goal. SEPTA adopted its advertising policy in 2015 after a court forced the transit agency to run offensive ads trying to tie Muslims to Hitler. The court there called SEPTA's ad space a, quote, designated public forum. In other words, a space like the proverbial town square where citizens would gather to engage in the free trade of ideas. By banning all sorts of debatable speech, SEPTA hopes the courts will now call the ad space on the side of public transit vehicles non-public. Then it'll be able to regulate ads without running afoul of the First Amendment. Tack Hooper finds that ironic.
SEPTA's ad policy has really turned the First Amendment on its head, saying that the more important the speech is, the less SEPTA wants it on its buses and subways.
If the ACLU wins, SEPTA may decide to end advertisements rather than place ads that scare off riders. In that case, the cost of free speech will be no speech at all. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
This disclosure, WHYY co-published the Center for Investigative Reporting article on mortgage lending and race. Over the last 2 days, WHYY has been looking at how school districts in the Philadelphia suburbs enforce student residency requirements. Many monitor students to make sure they actually live within the district boundaries and aren't using a fake address. But what does that monitoring actually entail? In the final installment of our series, Kicked Out, WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arant gives us an inside look.
On a recent weekday afternoon, Tina Blanchett is doing what a lot of moms do on weekday afternoons, waiting in a suburban parking lot for a kid.
I'm hoping they should be here in the next couple minutes.
While we sit in her white SUV, Blanchett fills the time talking about her three children and sighing about their fanatical commitment to soccer.
It's open practice, but of course they want to go, so I'm like, we'll go to practice tonight.
As we're talking, Alexis rolls by and catches Blanchett's attention.
That's our boy. So it's a good thing we didn't wait at the school.
And here is where Blanchett's parking lot idling takes a turn from the ordinary.
The closer he comes, the better for me. Totally our kid.
She whips out a small camera and films a teenage boy as he walks into his townhome.
That's the money shot right there. You know, that's what we call the money shot in the investigative world, is when you catch the person where you want to catch him.
Tina Blanchett is a private eye. She wanted to be a ballerina. After an injury and career detour, she eventually became secretary at a Westchester firm called ELPS Private Detective Agency.
That's how I started. I just, you know, filing paperwork, answering the phone.
After overhearing a lot of phone calls, she found her own calling.
I'd be listening and I'd be like, oh, I want to figure out. I want to get online. I want to run the data searches.
Blanchett's boss is longtime Detective Jeff Stein.
I specialize in criminal defense work. most of my clients are in prison for murder.
Stein's firm also tails cheating spouses and busts people who lie to collect workman's comp. But recently he's gotten more work from local school districts.
I would say in the last 5 years there's been an increase. So you're seeing more private investigators get involved in this, more requests by the school districts.
Stein says requests for his services started picking up during the Great Recession. Districts approach companies like his for two simple reasons.
Dollars and cents. It saves the taxpayers money.
If Stein's private eyes can prove a student lives outside district boundaries, that's one less student the district has to pay to educate.
We've conducted over 20 investigations in the last 14 months, and out of those, we've identified 10 who don't live in the school district.
ELPS is not the only player in this market. WHYY sent a series of right-to-know requests. We found that over the last 3 years, 17 school districts have paid outside firms to find out whether kids lived out of district. Every district has at least one person on staff who conducts residency cases. Some have as many as four. The William Penn School District in Delaware County recently hired someone whose only job is to conduct residency investigations. Frank Bruno is the district's director of pupil services.
People will change an address, they'll change a name, they'll change whatever they can. So we said this is too much to catch incidentally. We need somebody who can dedicate time to tracking this down.
It's hard to perfectly quantify how much money districts save by removing students, or if they save money at all. While it's true some districts spend more than $20,000 per pupil, removing a student wouldn't actually save you that much since there are built-in costs that wouldn't go away.
We're not moving out thousands of children.
Leanne Wenzel runs the Ridley School District in Delaware County.
To really make a major fiscal impact, you know, you're going to have to move out a big block of children.
But maybe the savings are in the big block of children who don't move in. Perhaps it deters families from jumping boundary lines when districts enforce the rules. Blanchette's client, a local school district we're not identifying, pays her firm to investigate families it suspects of fraud. A case can take anywhere from 10 to 60 hours of surveillance and cost between $750 and $4,000. A lot of the work just involves following kids and parents around to verify their addresses.
We've had kids as young as first grade that we've had to conduct surveillance on.
That may sound weird or even wrong, but even Maura McInerney, an advocate for accused families, supports the idea of surveillance. She'd rather districts do that than bring flimsy cases based on tipster hunches.
It is their burden to prove it, and it is their duty to ensure that they are not disenrolling children who actually do reside in their school district.
And so that's what folks like Blanchette get paid to do. The more domestic scenes they can capture on camera, the better. On our recent surveillance mission, Blanchette is about to leave when she hits her version of the mother load.
Oh, is he coming out with the dog?
Yeah, the dog's
He's coming out with the dog. I'm going to park and try and see if I can get him at a better angle.
So that's even better.
Yeah. Yep. Yep, yep, yep. So we got...
Because you saw his face.
I saw his face clearly. Yep. Clear as day.
As we drive back toward the office, I asked Blanchette about something she said earlier. She mentioned that she liked doing this type of work because she felt she was bringing bad guys to justice. I wondered if she enjoyed this kind of work, though, the times where she gets kids kicked out of their schools.
Now, do you ever feel like the bad guy?
I do. Yeah, I do. You know, it is difficult. This is one of the times in the job where you sort of have to separate yourself from the emotional aspect of it because this kid's going to get kicked out of our district.
But there's a bigger picture here, she says.
Yeah, I feel bad for the kid, but they're cheating the system.
The system looks like this. 63 school districts in the Pennsylvania suburbs outside Philadelphia, separating high quality from low, rich from poor. Tina Blanchette knows it's a system someone might be tempted to cheat. Avi Wolf-Manarant, WHYY News.
For more on our series Kicked Out, visit WHYY.org. On May 15th, Republican voters in Pennsylvania will be picking a nominee for governor to take on Democratic incumbent Tom Wolf in November. Today, we conclude our series of interviews with the three Republican gubernatorial candidates with a conversation with Pittsburgh businessman Paul Mango. Mango, a successful consultant in healthcare, has invested $6 million into his own campaign, a figure matched by rival Scott Wagner. Pittsburgh attorney Laura Ellsworth is also in the Republican primary. Mango spoke earlier today with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies.
Well, Paul Mango, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
You worked for years for McKinsey & Company, an international consulting firm. Tell us a little bit about what you did and how you think it would inform your work as governor.
Yeah. So three aspects of my work at McKinsey I think are important. One is I did it almost all of it in healthcare. But two other things that are quite important. McKinsey's a $10 billion firm. Someone has to build it. Someone has to run it. So I was privileged to lead a team over that 25 years that built a big global healthcare division of McKinsey. It's $500-600 million today. And then third, most important and most relevant to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is we structured and led major change transformational programs. Large organizations which had lost their way, couldn't serve their customers effectively or knew what to do, but they were too culturally restricted to change. And it's most difficult when it's a successful organization, a legacy of success, very difficult to bring positive change. That's what we did. I think that's the task in Harrisburg, is to bring positive change to a relatively antiquated organization.
One of your primary opponents, Scott Wagner, called you an Obamacare lover, which you just can't be in a Republican primary. The Harrisburg Patriot writer John Misek went over the evidence, and this is what he concluded. He said, it is true that Mango has spoken out publicly against the Affordable Care Act, and yes, he has called for its repeal, but it is also undeniably true that in his former profession, he spoke and wrote favorably about the law's effects on the economics of the hospital industry and how it could reduce the ranks of the uninsured.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one specific question. When Governor Wolf came into office, he accepted the expansion of Medicaid as provided in the Affordable Care Act. Would you maintain that expansion?
With waivers. Waivers that permit us to design and customize a Medicaid system that meets the needs of Pennsylvanians. And I'll just give you an example, Dave. We're an aging population. Our most vulnerable citizens and the ones that are drawing, that need to draw most upon Medicaid, are seniors who are indigent and oftentimes disabled. We have a tremendous shortage of skilled nursing beds or senior homes, mainly paid for by Medicaid, yet the governor expands Medicaid to young, healthy adults. I want Medicaid to address our most vulnerable citizens. We can't do that if we're going to invite healthy, able, young folks onto it.
Okay, but just to be clear about this, I mean, there are a lot of people who are working at full-time jobs that don't make a lot of money. Healthcare is expensive, and Medicaid enables them to get preventative care, to not rush to the emergency room. Don't folks deserve that kind of assistance?
We absolutely need to take care of folks and make sure they have access to health care. About 60% of the people, to my knowledge, on Medicaid are actually working, and that's very important. But they did not obtain skills that can create family-sustaining incomes, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. So, and here's why I'm stressing this, Dave, because I've talked to some of these workers. They feel locked into poverty. They're making $12 an hour. They're on Medicaid. They get food stamps. They get housing and child support. Their boss comes to them. They're doing a great job. Hey, I want to give you a promotion to supervisor. We'll bump you up to $18 an hour. They can't take it. The reason they say no is because they fall off a welfare cliff. So I think we want to, again, create the conditions and encourage people to pursue what I call earned success. And our Medicaid program is doing the opposite right now.
You talked about people getting people into family-sustaining jobs. Should we increase the minimum wage?
No. That will just eliminate entry-level jobs. I started as a newspaper carrier and then as a guy who rotated produce in a farmer's stand making $1.75 an hour. I learned a lot about leadership, teamwork, customer service. We will just destroy entry-level jobs if we raise the minimum wage. My role is to create maximum wage jobs for Pennsylvanians, and that's why I want to invest in education and vocational training and make sure everyone has the ability to sustain themselves with great family incomes.
Has Donald Trump been a good president?
I think he's been outstanding in a number of ways, and people can criticize him, but let's just review what's happened. The economy is the strongest I've seen in probably since 1999. What's that? 20 years. Rolling back regulations, tax reform. He tried health reform. Obviously, Justice Neil Gorsuch. I think he is bringing the change that he promised he would bring. The people of America elected him on a set of promises. I think he's doing it. But here's what I've been impressed with. I'm more impressed with him today than I was a year ago. Resilience, okay? I have a very, very small sense for what the guy's going through right now. I've never seen a president this resilient in the face of attacks every day. So I can tell you the intensity out in Pennsylvania for this guy on the Republican side is very, very strong. And I just salute President Trump for all he's done.
Paul Mango, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave. Always a pleasure.
WHYY's Dave Davies talking with Paul Mango, one of three Republican candidates for governor. Dave previously spoke with the other two, Laura Ellsworth and Scott Wagner. Imagine all the work it takes to make an animated film. There's the initial idea, storyboarding, the actual animation, and then making sure the whole film matches the original vision. Well, that process is unfolding with some unlikely producers at the helm, the writers of young patients at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and the students at Drexel University are helping them turn their visions into reality. WHYY's Nina Feldman has the story.
Join me, if you will, on a journey to a faraway planet where the trees are purple and the land is defended by an angel named Alexandria.
For the last time, I didn't kill your family.
You're dead!
This fantasy world comes from the mind of 17-year-old Genevieve Mitzel. She says she based her main character off herself, with a couple key differences.
I've always wanted to fly, I guess. So I'm like, okay, I'll give her wings so she can fly. She's a lot like me, just how I'd be if I was able to fly, basically. It's the only difference is the wings.
Mitzel has cystic fibrosis, a genetic disorder that affects the respiratory and digestive systems and which can be life-threatening. For Mitzel, that means she gets regular lung infections, which land her in the hospital for weeks at a time. And that can be pretty boring. That's where the animation project comes in.
It just helps me forget that I'm here, like, in the hospital, having to go through all the antibiotics and all this stuff.
Victoria Milano is a sophomore psychology major at Drexel and helped transform Mitzel's idea into a short film. She says every time she'd visit the hospital, she'd leave feeling inspired.
You would think that it would be the total opposite, walking into a children's hospital and working with patients that are so sick and have such different lives. But it makes you realize, like, this is why I'm studying what I want to study.
Four CHOP patients were selected for the program and gathered with their animators and producers to screen the films and celebrate. Nina Feldman, WHYY News.
The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, addresses issues that remain controversial: gun ownership, unreasonable searches and seizures, the right to a trial before an impartial jury, among others. In an effort to foster dialogue on these hot-button issues, the National Constitution Center is staging Living News, performances that illustrate differing sides of the arguments. The actors visited WHYY to present one of the scenes, the First Amendment.
In Washington, the Supreme Court announced
at the White House today, the president delivered a defense of U.S. trade policies as it relates to China and the Far East.
And in Maryland today, First Amendment issues boiled to the surface at the historic Antietam battlefield.
Big doings here today. Today is the anniversary of the Battle of Antietam, fought on this very spot. That's the battle that changed the course of the Civil War. And it just so happened to take place on the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. I mention all of this because there's a Ku Klux Klan rally here today.
To the editor, I was horrified to learn that the park superintendent has given permission to the Ku Klux Klan to hold a rally. There is no way that they should be allowed to speak there on the anniversary of one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War.
People are all fired up. They don't want the KKK here, and after the violence in Charlottesville, there's good reason to be concerned. But as long as they demonstrate peacefully, we can't stop them. That's the law. Congress and the courts have been defining our free speech rights since 1791.
My ancestors fought in the Civil War. My grandfather's great uncle bled to death right here at Antietam. That's why I brought my boys here today.
So here I am, a black man saying to the press that I'm going to give this hateful organization a permit to speak. As you can imagine, I'm not getting a lot of fan mail. 30 emails alone this morning.
Are you crazy letting those people speak? Do you know what they stand for?
See what I mean? Not that there aren't reasons to keep them out. There's the high cost of security, for one thing.
The park superintendent knew he had no right to keep the Klan out. Prevent us from speaking our mind just because he doesn't agree with our values.
I know there's freedom of speech, but how can the Constitution allow people to talk hatefully about their neighbors? Sign me, angry.
I've had lots of times in my life when I thought my race was an issue. Times when people pushed me around, or worse. This is not one of those times.
How can you say
this
that?
This is about basic rights, ours and theirs.
I don't think that.
Now, with the Klan, they stand up and say a lot of ugly things, and you can say, I reject what you're saying.
I do reject what they're saying.
But you have to allow them the right to say it. You don't end hate by banning hate speech. You can argue with them and show the world why they are wrong. That's the marketplace of ideas. We have to let people draw their own conclusions. Or you can choose not to listen. That's your right.
They can disagree with our opinions, but I think people are stealing our nation away from us. They talk about protecting free speech, but what about our right to speak? The Constitution is supposed to be an umbrella. But it seems to me we're being left out in the rain.
The North won the Battle of Antietam, and eventually the war. That led to Congress passing the 13th Amendment, ending slavery. I'll hold the Constitution up against the Klan's ideas anytime.
Dana Orange, Minu Porcheriati, and Sidney Shawless performing a scene from Living News, now currently running at the National Constitution Center. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight, produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.